Watchman's Teaching Letter, Volume 2, The Demise of Edom. Watchman's Teaching Letter Number 31, November 2000. From the 2000 Watchman's Teaching Letters by Clifton Emmeheiser, read by Dan Adams. This is my 31st monthly teaching letter and continues my third year of publication. In the last two letters, number 29 and 30, we covered the Hurrians and Hittites. We found they were a Mongolian people. We also discovered that the Egyptian pharaohs took women of these peoples into their harems, and later pharaohs were from these bloodlines. We found that not only did the pharaohs mix blood, but also there was much mixing by the Egyptian people themselves. In lesson number 30, I diverged from this theme to the topics of biblical tithing and new research on two-seed line doctrine. Also, we covered, to some degree, the archaeological find at Ebla. Because the subject of Egypt is so long and strung out time-wise, I am not sure how many lessons will be required to cover it in connection with Esau Edom. While we are on the subject, there are simply many items we cannot omit. I believe after we have researched this subject, you will see Egypt in an entirely new light. I believe you will be enraptured with it. You will want to continue researching it for yourself, for Egyptian history is like no other chronicles in the world. For the part of Egyptian history we are interested in and how Egyptian history fits in with biblical history, I will present some evidence of what Egyptian and biblical history is not. It is my responsibility as a watchman on the wall, whenever someone is exhibiting falsehood along any biblical subject, to expose the false teaching for what it is. Once you have attained the truth of a matter, it will be your responsibility to judge any writer on the topic for what he or she is. I doubt very much if I were to show this writer undeniable, irrefutable, positive evidence of his error that he would change his position but continue his teachings in spite of the reliable testimony to the contrary. But you must be the judge in the end. We certainly don't need any more confusion, as we have already had too much. What Egyptian and biblical history is not. This next paragraph interspersed with my comments. The book to which I refer is Hebrew Sages of Ancient Egypt, A Revised Discipline in Antiquity, by F. David Fry, Jr. The reason I believe this man would not change his position is because he has written several books and made several cassette tape lectures on the subject, and therefore he would be reluctant to change his posture even in the face of overwhelming credible evidence. He's one of those who's made his bad investments and would refuse to accept that he has been demonstrated by the facts a loser and a sucker for buying or inventing his falsehood. Unless, of course, he's a quote-unquote Jew, in which case it's something else. In any case, it's just too much humble pie to ask a man to eat. And Clifton is right. There are many out there like this man, and of course, we are only speaking here of our own race, so this applies squarely to us. After all, we are the descendants of those stiff-necked people the prophets complained of. So here it is. F. David Fry's position is that, drumroll, Egyptian history is 1,000 years younger than historians claim. Fry? Never heard of him, but he's clearly got some agenda to serve, some axe to grind. In Chapter 2, pages 5 and 6, Fry says the following. The birth of Egypt and her exaggerated antiquity. For almost 200 years, historians have calculated that Egypt's history retreats in time far enough to predate the supposed Hebrew myth of Noah's flood, 2350 BC. Indeed, historians extend this retreat even beyond the biblical creation date, 4004 BC, Usher. To rectify this difference, some theologians reasoned that populations existed before Adam and Eve, while others are forced to disclaim the biblical world wide flood. Now, boy, does this guy really sound ignorant. Clearly an idiot, probably a clown too, but we'll try to remain patient. Over the last 100 years, Egypt's history has been steadily revised downward from 5000 BC, First Dynasty, to today's 3000 BC. Even so, the anomaly still exists unless something gives. The question we must answer here is, whose history should give? Egypt's or the Hebrews? End quote. On pages 13 and 14, Fry associates the First Dynasty tomb of Unefes, fourth king of Dynasty 1. Hebrew history suggests that the designer of this tomb was the celebrated and world-famous sage Abraham. I, Fry, shall go one step further. I, Fry, propose that Abraham is the only person in all history who could be common to the tomb, its design, and the era in which it was built, end quote. Fry continues on page 19. It is obvious that the traditional time model needs drastic revision. It needs to either push the era of Abraham further back in history or pull Egypt's history drastically forward, end quote. Fry further states on page 20, we must connect Abraham's era with the First Dynasty. It explicitly places Abraham on the Egyptian scene 1,000 years earlier than where he has commonly been placed. The life and times of that great Hebrew sage Abraham occurred during Dynasty 1 and not 1,000 years later, as traditional history teaches, end quote. Fry continues, page 28. As already established, Abraham did not live during Egypt's Middle Kingdom Dynasty 12, end quote. Fry places Joseph as the same person as Imhotep, page 35. Since Joseph was vizier of Egypt and Imhotep was also vizier, is it possible they might just be the same person, end quote. On page 38, Fry continues to suggest that Joseph and Imhotep were the same person. Is it possible to establish a medical parallel between this famous healing god, Imhotep, and Joseph the Hebrew sage, end quote. Fry continues on page 39, if this is found to be true, then we must conclude that Joseph Imhotep was the inventor or at least initiator of pathology, coupling him, Joseph, to both Imhotep and the Old Kingdom, end quote. Continuing on page 41, Fry quotes Peter Tompkins' Secrets of the Great Pyramid, page 168. However, it remains distinctly possible that Poth Imhotep could have been Joseph himself, end quote. On pages 42 and 43, Fry says, the truth is that chronologists should properly reassign Egypt's third dynasty to the days of Joseph, for we are fast arriving at the startling but verifiable conclusion that Joseph, Imhotep, and Pothotep were one and the same man. All three men lived during dynasties 3 and 4. Once again, the probability increases that Joseph, Imhotep, and Pothotep were the same individual, end quote. On page 51, Fry says, yes, Joseph was Imhotep, end quote. Fry continues on page 91. Moses found in Egyptian records, with Dynasty 5 ruling far up the Nile to the south and Dynasty 6 ruling adjacent to Goshen, we should consider Dynasty 6 as the prime candidate for the place when Moses was born, end quote. On page 92, Fry makes the following remark. That shift will make Egypt 1,000 years younger at the time of Moses, end quote. On page 94, Fry again mentions Moses with the 6th dynasty. As we will see, the Exodus story is a perfect fit to the end of the 6th dynasty, the end of the Old Kingdom era, end quote. Further, Fry remarks on page 95, historians can find no place in Dynasty 18, 19, or even 20 when baby Moses could have been an adopted heir to Egypt's throne. Yes, Moses was raised in Egypt during the 6th dynasty, not the 18th dynasty, end quote. In short, Fry places Abraham with dynasty number 1, Joseph with dynasty number 3, and Moses with dynasty number 6. He could probably get by with the scenario if it were not for the facts revealed by some very important archaeological discoveries in recent times. The 18th Egyptian dynasty, or the New Kingdom. Because we are going to be dealing with the 18th Egyptian dynasty, dated circa 1543 to 1292 BC, we should get familiar with their names. Spelling of names will vary slightly from one reference book to another. These Egyptian pharaohs are in the sequence as follows: Ahmoses, Amenhotep I, Tutmosis I, Tutmosis II, Hatshepsut, Tutmosis III, Amenhotep II, Tutmosis IV, Amenhotep III, Amenhotep IV, same as Akhenaten, Tutankhamun, I, Horemheb. Archaeology proves Fry's thesis totally in error. Finds at Jericho prove beyond all doubt that Fry cannot be correct. If you know your Bible story of Jericho, it will be remembered that after the Israelites destroyed it, Joshua placed a curse on it that it would never again be occupied. With this in mind, let's read the Thompson Chain Reference Bible Archaeological Supplement, page 1802, copyright 1990. As Thompson is continually updating this supplement, your copy may read differently from the one I am quoting. I will be only quoting a portion of this article. On the outskirts of the old city mound, Garstang discovered a cemetery where he opened scores of graves that yielded quantities of pottery vessels, considerable jewelry, and about 170 scarab beetles. In these tombs, he found pottery from the early, middle, and late Bronze periods, but only a few shards of Mycenaean ware. The Egyptian scarabs can be dated with certainty, since they mention various pharaohs by name and represent each of them from Tutmosis III. One scarab bears the name of Queen Hatshepsut and Tutmosis III, another that of Amenhotep II, who is depicted as an archer, corresponding well with his tomb records in Egypt. The series of dated scarabs end with the two royal seals of Amenhotep III. Nothing else in the tombs suggests later dates, end quote. For more evidence that this documentation is correct, I will now quote from Wonders of the Past in two volumes edited by Sir J. A. Hamerton. Jericho and the Biblical Story, a portion from page 1220. Notice the slight difference in spelling of the pharaoh's names. Happily again, the evidence from the tombs as regards this period is complete and satisfactory. It is represented by hundreds of intact specimens. Their stratification is undisturbed, and their continuity is attested by the discovery at the appropriate levels of further royal Egyptian scarabs, notably one of Tutmosis III, the successor of Queen Hatshepsut, in Tomb 5, and two of Amenhotep III in Tomb 4, and with his reign the deposits in the tombs and city alike come to an abrupt end. End quote. Bingo! If you are aware of Egyptian history, then you understand the above-named pharaohs were of the 18th dynasty, a time period which Fry wholly disallowed. If you want to believe Fry, in spite of this evidence, it's your choice, but don't say you were never told. This evidence puts F. David Fry, Jr. totally out of the ballpark on his thesis. You will remember, Joshua was only one generation after Moses and only 40 years after the Exodus. If this doesn't suggest an Egyptian-Hebrew time comparison, I don't know what it would take to do so. But this is not the only evidence of this time similitude. For further documentation that we are on the right track, I will now quote From the National Geographic magazine, December 1987, a story of the oldest known shipwreck reveals splendors of the Bronze Age. This shipwreck, according to National Geographic, represents seven civilizations that flourished in the Eastern Mediterranean area in late Bronze Age times. Thousands of other items provide an astonishing portrait of an era symbolized by the reign of Egypt's Tutankhamun and the fall of Troy, end quote. Tutankhamun is only the second pharaoh past Amenhotep III, whose scarab was found at Jericho. This shipwreck is closely contemporary with Moses, Joshua, and the Exodus. While this shipwreck contained many items of interest, I would like to quote from pages 731 and 732. Tufan saved the best for last. One morning he surfaced with the small plastic box he stored his treasures in and lifted a solid gold scarab pictured on same page. As we do with all our finds, we photographed the scarab and I later took the slides back to Texas. It had been more than 30 years since I studied hieroglyphics, but with the help of an Egyptian dictionary, I translated the end of the inscription on the base of the golden beetle, Nefertiti. Nefertiti, is there a more beautiful face from antiquity than that of Pharaoh Akhenaten's great queen? Her timeless features have been captured for eternity in the exquisite bust from Tell el Amarna. Temple inscriptions record the fact that Nefertiti was an important figure in her husband's reign, but just how important has been a question in modern times. Some scholars believe she was immensely powerful, possibly the co-ruler of Egypt. Not only was this the first gold scarab ever found of the exquisite beauty of the Aten, sun disk, Nefertiti, as her full name is translated, it also was the first artifact found in Asia Minor or the Aegean that names either the famous Akhenaten or his beautiful wife. Akhenaten's son was Tutankhamun. Was the scarab carried by an envoy of Nefertiti? We can only guess. The scarab is well worn. Kemal's map of the wreck site shows that it was found near the scrap gold, suggesting that it may have belonged to the same hoard. If it did, the ship sank after Nefertiti's death, for one cannot imagine her scarab being discarded during her reign, end quote. Among other items found at the site of the shipwreck were Cypriot pottery and a wooden folding tablet called a diptych, spoken of by Homer. He sent him to Lycia, and gave him baneful signs in a folding wooden tablet, Iliad, Book 4, line 169, which helps date the contents discovered. With this evidence, there is no way F. David Fry, Jr. can be correct with this supposition. Now we can know what Egyptian history is not, and that we are indeed dealing with the 18th Egyptian dynasty for the Exodus. As we continue along, you will start to see how well all of this fits the overall portrayal of Egyptian history, along with events pertaining to the Hebrews of the Bible. In quoting from the Thompson Chain Reference Bible, Wonders of the Past, and the National Geographic, I intentionally left out the dates. I did this because I believe that Garstang may be 120 to 160 years off on his dates. In the Bible and Archaeology by J. A. Thompson, it states on page 59, this state of affairs suggests that the Exodus did not take place till after 1300 B.C. On page 60, this same book says, Garstang made a case for the fall of Jericho in 1400 B.C. and an Exodus in about 1440 B.C. End quote. This discrepancy doesn't, however, rule out the 18th dynasty, 1543 to 1292 BC, for these events. A starting point. A good place to start our story of Egypt would be a city called On. We are told by most reference books that On represented the heathen worship of the sun god. I hope to set the record straight concerning this city. Originally, On was called Beth Shemesh, House of Shem. It was not until the time of Akhenaten that a temple was built to Aten, the sun god. I find the documentation for this in the book The Bohm Journey to Egypt. That's B-O-E-H-M, The Bohm Journey to Egypt, Land of Tutankhamun by Frank J. Cosentino, page 48. Akhenaten had to have a circle of loyal adherents who converted to his new religion. Friendly foreign princes were not particularly concerned with the change and accepted it as long as their relationships with the royal house were maintained. The king steadfastly forged ahead, trying to impose his new philosophies on Egyptian life. He succeeded in building temples to Aten in Thebes, Genatam in Nubia, Heliopolis, Memphis, Hermopolis, Hermothus, and in some smaller cities, end quote. In the Haley's Bible Handbook by Henry H. Haley, page 107, it states, Joseph made ruler of Egypt. Joseph married a daughter of the priest of On, a Shemite, folks. And though he had a heathen wife and ruled a heathen kingdom and resided in the center of vile idolatry, he maintained his childhood faith in the God of his fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, end quote. I'm going to have to beg to differ with Haley on Joseph's wife, for it appears she was of the house of Shem, just as Tamar was, the mother of Phares and Zara. And I don't believe that Joseph's father-in-law was practicing vile idolatry, for he was a priest of Beth Shemesh. It is also evident that there were at least some Shemites in Egypt during Joseph's time, and Joseph didn't marry a heathen as implied. We totally agree, because both parties to a marriage under Yahweh's law, regardless of how far apart they were in origin, would be aware of the racial dimensions to their faith, unlike we living in 2014, under strong delusions concerning our identity, our proper faith, our innate response to Yahweh's laws, etc. Akhenaten's new religion, where did he get it? For the answer to this question, I am going to refer to a book entitled Barnes General History by Joel Dorman Steele and Esther Baker Steele, copyright 1883 and 1889, page 17, and it is simply amazing what these two writers were able to establish, considering the archaeology that had been done up to their time. Khuenaten, Akhenaten, the heretic king, rejected the Theban gods for the one god Aten, sun worship of his foreign mother. He founded a new capital, now Tel el Amarna, ruins, but neither capital nor religion long survived him, end quote. It says here that Akhenaten got his religion from his mother. Much can be determined from the Egyptian statuary of Akhenaten and his mother, Queen Tiye. Akhenaten was so overpowering in Mongolian features, we don't even have to guess what bloodline he and his mother were from. Akhenaten's mother was considered a non-royal commoner, wife of Amenhotep III. Therefore, the only conclusion which can be made is that Akhenaten's mother was one of the women which were sent to Egypt by the Hurrians in the peace treaty Egypt made with them. The Bible as History by Werner Keller, page 98, pages vary in different editions, states, in three successive generations of rulers, Indo-Aryan, meaning Hurrians, and Egyptian blood was mixed for the first time, end quote. This being true, Akhenaten and his relation were of the serpent seed line. There are many pictures of Akhenaten in Egyptian books, so you won't have any trouble identifying him as such. A picture is worth a thousand words. We can trust these portrayals and sculptures, for they were developed in greater detail during the Akhenaten era than at any other time in Egyptian history." End quote. What you see is what you get. You can be very sure if Akhenaten looked Mongolian, he was indeed Mongolian. And so, it is not such a stretch to interpret Christ's words regarding sheep and goats in exactly the same way. What he sees is what he gets. Further information concerning the mixing of the Egyptian pharaohs with the Hurrians is found in the book The Pyramids and Sphinx by Desmond Stewart, page 51. To understand, you may need my previous lessons dealing with the Hurrians. Tutmosis IV's immediate descendants. Products of his marriage to the daughter of the king of Mitanni, Hurrian, a powerful new state in northern Syria, were no less arresting. His son by his foreign queen was Amenhotep III, builder of colossal statues, in which he and his non-royal wife, Tiye, are posed as equals, unlike most earlier groups, in which a queen might be a quarter the size of her spouse. One unforgettable late portrait, a bitter come-down from such colossi as still stand on the west bank of the Nile, facing Luxor, shows Amenhotep III looking like a weary and corpulent overweight chairman of some giant corporation. The son of Amenhotep III and Tiye was the greatest eccentric in Egyptian history, the heretic who, by changing his name from Amenhotep to Akhenaten, incorporated into his new title the Aten that his grandfather had honored. This outstanding family, with its characteristically oval-shaped faces, large noses, and insubstantial builds, presided over a renaissance of Egyptian power, a transformation of Egyptian culture, and ironically, the first intimations hint of final decline. End quote. A further description of Akhenaten's physical features is given on page 65 as follows. His elongated head, heavy lips, large ears, distended stomach, and wide hips, which were undoubtedly the end product of generations of royal inbreeding, end quote. I would rather suggest outbreeding with other races. If what we are reading here is true, with the blood mixing of the Egyptian pharaohs with the Hurrians, the pharaoh enslaving the Hebrews may well have been of the Cain satanic seed line. For more information in regards to this product of Amenhotep III and Queen Tiye, the Hurrian, I will again quote from the book The Pyramids and Sphinx by Desmond Stewart, page 64. The heir of Amenhotep III and Queen Tiye assumed the throne under his father's name, Amenhotep, but then abruptly renamed himself Akhenaten. On the new king's orders, the name of the god Amen-Ra, Amen-Re, was deleted from most monuments. At the same time, the pharaoh moved his residence from Thebes to a new hastily built capital some 300 miles to the north. The site, a half-moon-shaped plain on the east bank of the Nile, had been visited by Akhenaten's grandfather, Tutmosis IV. The new capital, with its sunlit open temple to the Aten, was an attempt at utopia and was given the name Akhenaten, or Horizon of the Aten. The site's modern name, Tel El Amarna, comes from the names of two nearby Arab villages. The city was not without an economic base, since all the riverborne transport headed north and east passed by it, and could be milked to the disadvantage of rival Thebes. End quote. New religion, new city. To understand this part of Akhenaten's story, I will quote from the book Wonders of the Past in two volumes, edited by Sir J. A. Hamerton. Tel el Amarna, City of Akhenaten and Tutankhamun, pages 1123 and 1124. A closer examination of the immediate foreground detects a series of long, low mounds, many of which have been, so to speak, disemboweled and disclose ruins of mud-brick walls. To the right there rise two sickly palm trees and a solitary flat-roofed house, the home of the excavators. A modern village or two with their domed tombs lie half-concealed in the palm plantations. The site, somewhat unpromising at first glance, has proved one of the most thrilling in the Near East. It is the only city of ancient Egypt yet uncovered. Its life was short, barely a score of years, yet from its remains has been obtained a vivid picture of the life of the pharaoh's court, of his nobles, and of the poorer classes. Whereas the government archives of Tel el Amarna throw a flood of light on international relations at one of the most momentous periods in ancient times. But even greater interest attaches to the place from the cause of its foundation. Its existence is due to a great religious revolution, the only one that ever convulsed Egypt, that home of rigid conservatism, during several thousands of years. Under Amenhotep III, the priesthood of Amen, at Thebes, had grown dangerously powerful. On his death, his widow, Queen Tiye, a remarkable woman of non-royal birth, encouraged her 12-year-old son, now Amenhotep IV, later to become known as Akhenaten, to give precedence to the sun god Ra, who, after being paramount in earlier times, had now been ousted by Amon. The boy king accordingly erected a temple at Thebes to Ra under the form of Aten, or Aten, the sun's disk, by which he intended to symbolize the deity behind the sun who gives heat and life to the world. He thus at one sweep superseded the worship of Amon, and with it that of the whole Egyptian pantheon, substituting an ideal monotheism. Finding it impossible to make any headway in the stronghold of Amon himself, he decided, no doubt with his mother's support, on the bold plan of changing his capital. End quote. New god, new name. So he sailed downstream some 250 miles and founded a new city on a virgin site belonging to no god or goddess, no prince or princess, and of which no man could claim ownership. At the same time, as an outward sign of his complete break with the old polytheism, he changed his name from Amenhotep, Amon is at rest, to Akhenaten, the Aten is satisfied. Here he erected the temple to the Aten, 250 feet square, within an oblong enclosure half a mile in length. Close by were the palace buildings, covering a space of 1,500 by 1,500 feet. End quote. Moses named after the 18th dynasty pharaohs. This may come as a surprise to many of you, but Moses was named from a pharaoh family of the 18th dynasty. For a reference of this sort of thing, I will refer to a book, Civilization Before Greece and Rome, by H. W. E. Sags, S-A-G-G-S, page 105. At some periods, when scribes signed documents, they added the names and professions of their father after their own names, and from this we learn something about the class to which they belonged. At the end of the third millennium, they were mainly sons, or rarely daughters, of well-to-do people, such as city governors, temple administrators, army officers, tax officials, or priests. We also find reference to poor orphan boys being adopted by generous patrons who, at the height of their kindness, put them to learn the scribal art. End quote. The following are a list of pharaohs with this name: Ahmoses, Tutmosis I, Tutmosis II, Tutmosis III, and Tutmosis IV. It is now just a matter of finding out which Moses is the pharaoh family which adopted Moses and gave him their name. Exodus 2:10 definitely states that the pharaoh's daughter named him. And the child grew, and she brought him unto Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she called his name Moses. And she said, "Because I drew him out of the water." End quote. Evidently the meaning, "I drew him out of the water," for Moses' name, is attributed only by modern commentators and became a secondary meaning for his name. I made a search and couldn't find any Hebrew word combination that would suggest such a meaning. It is obvious the daughter of the Pharaoh didn't go to him and say, "Look at this Hebrew child I just saved from the river." If that would have been the meaning of his name at the time, the Pharaoh would have taken Moses to the river and personally drowned him, for the Pharaoh had made two different decrees. The first decree was an order to the midwives to kill any male Hebrew children, Exodus 1:16. The second decree by the Pharaoh was to cast the male Hebrew children into the river, Exodus 1:22. Actually, the Pharaoh's order was being obeyed in the case of Moses, but the Pharaoh didn't stipulate not to place a Hebrew child in a waterproof basket. So far, we have established beyond all reasonable doubt, with the aid of archaeological evidence, that Moses and the Exodus must have taken place in the 18th Egyptian dynasty. It has also been established that the city of On was originally a Shemitic city, and that Joseph did not marry out of his kinship. We have also learned a pharaoh by the name of Akhenaten and the new city he built to his god Aten, also that Akhenaten was of a mixed Egyptian Hurrian bloodline. 19th Egyptian dynasty excluded for the Exodus. Most biblical scholars place the Exodus at the time of Meremptah, son of Ramesses II, in the 19th Egyptian dynasty. If you have a Haley's Bible handbook, you might check page 116 for his explanation of this period. This has been the popular and traditional placement for the Exodus, yet there are no indications of Egypt experiencing any momentous changes at that particular time, as the Exodus story might require. The 19th dynasty went along unbroken. Ramesses I, Seti I, Ramesses II, Meremptah, Amenmesse, Seti II, Siptah, Tausret. This sequence of pharaohs is taken from the Penguin Historical Atlas of Ancient Egypt by Bill Manley. The best evidence I have found in my research to conclude the Israelites were not slaves under the pharaohs of the 19th dynasty is found on a limestone fragment pictured in National Geographic magazine of April 1991, page 5, in an article entitled "Ramesses the Great," spellings vary for his name. This relief depicts Ramesses holding three prisoners by their hair with his right hand while holding a hatchet in his other hand. National Geographic comments thusly: clutching Nubian, Libyan, and Syrian prisoners by their hair, Ramesses wields an axe to dispatch them. Egyptian reliefs like this limestone fragment from the ancient capital of Memphis proclaim only victories, never defeats. Such painted propaganda had undeviating purpose: to ensure loyalty and inspire fear. End quote. Totally missing from this relief is an Israelite. One might argue the Syrian would represent an Israelite. We know the wars in which Ramesses was engaged, and these three represented prisoners of war, not Israelites. It is fairly obvious that Ramesses II had an entirely different labor force by this time, rather than the children of Israel. The Syrians here were probably Hurrians. Bible scholars have also connected Ramses II with the building of Python and Ramses Exodus 1:11. I don't believe that this is a valid argument, as there was a land of Ramses mentioned in Joseph's time. Haley's Bible Handbook says of Ramses II on page 116, "It is, however, known that Ramses II was a great plagiarist, taking to himself credit for some of the monuments of his predecessors, having his own name carved on their monuments." End quote. The same National Geographic magazine of April 1991, page 17, in an article entitled "Ramses the Great Says of Ramses II," "He also took credit for many structures built by his predecessors, chiseling out their names and substituting his. He commissioned so much art," says Rita Freed of Boston's Museum of Fine Arts, "that it became mass production. He seems more interested in quantity, not quality. There probably weren't enough good artists. Whereas his predecessors chiseled a lot of raised relief, he chose sunken relief. It's easier to do and harder for your successors to chisel away." End quote. In the next lesson, I will be documenting and placing Joseph, Moses, and the Exodus, all within the 18th Egyptian dynasty. End of Watchman's Teaching Letter No. 31. Thank you for listening.